This is a resurrection story, read by somebody who is a testimony of resurrection. I think this story of Paul is a resurrection story just like the one we read 2 weeks ago on Easter. I think there's even deliberate parallels in this story when you look at it. I mean, this is a story about somebody who is committed to death. I mean, he's pursuing the death of the early Christian movement, and not only that, the death of Christians. He's appeared in the gospel, or in the book of Acts already. We see him standing and watching as Philip is stoned, the first person in Acts who's killed for his beliefs. Paul stands there, watches it, and is complicit in that. He's committed to death. And then on his way to Damascus, where he's going to continue to do what he's committed to do, he is confronted. And there's a blinding light, and there's a question that he can't answer, and he can't see after that. He goes into a period of darkness. Did you notice how long? Yes. Remind you of anything? Remind you of anything? 3 days in the tomb, 3 days of darkness, and then something happens. Something happens where he regains his vision and he changes completely. He goes from being committed to death to becoming somebody who's committed to new life. He says, in retrospect, he writes in Galatians, reflecting on his life, he says, "It is I who have died, and Christ who lives now in me." So reflecting on this experience himself, he says he experienced not just resurrection, but death and resurrection. What a story. Now, 2 weeks ago, we read another resurrection story, the story of the resurrection of Jesus. And as Tim just pointed out, every year we follow that story. Every year, the Revised Common Lectionary directs all churches to follow that story with the story of Doubting Thomas. So as soon as we hear the story of resurrection, the suggestion comes from Scripture and from Christian tradition that you ask the question, is that really possible? And we talked last week about what a gift that question can be to an individual and to a community. So it seems only appropriate, upon reading another resurrection story, the story of Paul, that we ask that question again. What question was it? Is this possible? Is it possible? Is it possible for somebody to make this significant of a personal change? Can you really change your mind when you are committed to one way of seeing yourself and seeing the world? When you are committed to a path of action in your life based on a certain set of firm beliefs, is it really possible to change? You ever wonder that? You ever wonder that about somebody you know? Will they ever change? Do you ever wonder it about yourself? Am I ever going to change? This question, as it turns out, is not just of interest to theologians, and not just of interest to psychotherapists, but it's of interest, as you might imagine, to sociologists and political scientists as well. And there has been a great deal of study on this question. Is it possible to change people's minds? Okay? These are studies that, of course, are run, and a lot of them have been done around political messaging and political campaigning, right? Political ads. And there's lots of other studies as well. And study after study has come back with very depressing results. It is extremely hard to change anybody's mind about anything. Political ads, there's a lot of research that's been done about them. There's strong evidence that you can change somebody's mind immediately after watching a political ad. If you put them in a laboratory, show them an ad, ask them their opinion of a candidate before and after seeing their ad, people sometimes will change their mind about that candidate after seeing the ad. But go and interview them the next day. Interview them a week later. And across the board, people have gone back to what they originally thought. Fascinating, huh? People basically don't change their minds about political candidates. And so as a result, political campaigning now is almost entirely focused on people who already agree with a candidate, building up excitement and getting those people to be energized enough to go and vote. Now, when it comes to a lot of other issues, there's a lot of other studies. I live with somebody, as you know, who's a meteorologist and who works a lot on the issues of global warming. Lots of studies about how you can change people's minds about global warming, all of them very depressing. And that here's one. They have a problem, in fact, with these studies, with something that's called the backlash effect, in fact. So one study in particular comes to mind. This one was done with people who don't believe in vaccinations, who have doubts about the efficacy of vaccinations or the safety of vaccinations, right? So they bring all these people into the laboratory, show them all sorts of different information. Some people get pamphlets. Some people get talks. Some people get videos. Then they survey them all afterwards. This particular study, they called off the study midway because, as it turned out, everybody had strengthened their opposition to vaccinations by the time that all of this was done. That's called the backlash effect. The more somebody tries to persuade you to change your view, the more entrenched your view becomes. The more evidence they present to you, the more you're sure. You're sure that someone's trying to con you because you really understand what's going on. Very depressing. With this thought that any of us could ever change our minds about anything. So it was very exciting to researchers when a study came out in 2014 that had some very, very positive results about this situation where they're trying to get people to change their mind. Maybe you heard this about this study. I heard about it because there was a big story about it in This American Life in 2015. So this study took place. I'll give you just a little bit of backstory. I have to be careful I don't go on too long about this one because it's very interesting. But you might remember that in 2008, California passed something that was called Proposition 8. Anybody remember what that was about? What was it about? Nope. Another proposition in California, but this Prop 8 was, anyone? Yeah, outlawed gay marriage. It was a big surprise to a lot of people in California, where gay marriage had been, well, it had been going back and forth, but at the time it had been legalized, and this proposition was on the ballot the same year that Obama got elected, and they amended the state constitution to outlaw gay marriage. Big defeat for the gay and lesbian rights community, and a real puzzling situation for a lot of people who thought there was stronger support in California than there proved to be around issues around marriage equality. And especially the Los Angeles GLBT Center is the largest such organization in the United States. Very well funded in a very, liberal community. And Los Angeles had voted in favor of Proposition 8. Big shock. And so they went through and got a bunch of funding and decided that what they were going to do was send canvassers out to figure out why people had voted for Proposition 8. Do you understand what I'm saying? Their mission was not to persuade anybody. Their mission was, they were kind of on like a fact-finding. They were trying to figure out how to respond, and so they felt like they needed to go and actually investigate. So the job for the canvassers, who were all volunteers, was to knock on people's doors in areas that had, by far voted against Proposition 8. No, voted for Proposition 8 against gay marriage, to knock on the door and to ask a series of open-ended questions about that person's views around gay marriage. And then at the end, because all of these people were volunteers and had a lot of passions themselves, the people who were directing the canvassing effort had a little note and they said, if you want, you can add a personal statement at the end of this interview. Well, they also sent along with a lot of these interviewers, there were people who were taking videos. They were recording the information, not just by making notes, but by taking a video. And when they started to watch the videos, they started to see people changing their mind. That as they had these open-ended conversations that ended with the person who was doing the canvassing, often coming out to the person, describing their own opinions, their own struggles, often there was a real connection. These conversations were not short. This is not like the conversation you have with the person who's trying to sell siding to you who comes to your door. They said they took a minimum of 20 minutes. Some of them lasted 90 minutes. They talked to the person at their door. But they saw evidence that people were changing their mind. So this got the attention of some researchers, specifically a researcher who was a graduate student at UCLA, whose name was Michael LaCour. And he was supervised by this guy at Columbia, a political scientist named Donald Green, very famous political scientist. And they set up a study of what these canvassers were already doing. Do you understand what I'm saying? It's not like they ran a controlled experiment. They were doing this, and they studied it. But they put in some controls that would make it a more legitimate study. They, for example, had a whole control group, people who were knocking on doors of people and talking to them about recycling. That was the control group. And then the other group was talking about gay marriage. They surveyed everybody beforehand about their opinions about gay marriage, and then they surveyed them afterwards, and they surveyed them 3 months afterwards. Okay? And the evidence started to come in, and it was extremely positive. So not only were people changing their mind at the end of the conversation, but almost all of those people had still changed their mind 3 months later. And on top of that, they said they had talked to other people about the issue themselves. And so very exciting. Big story. Published the results in the journal Science, a very well-regarded scientific journal. News outlets picked it up, story in the Washington Post, and big profile of this on that radio show, This American Life. The only problem with this study, do you guys know? Did you hear about this? Ken is the only one who's heard the story, maybe. But as it turned out, all of the evidence was fabricated. So this researcher, Michael LaCour, who they were taking evidence and writing it down. I mean, this canvassing effort was going on, but the people who were recording the results, they weren't recording the results. And this idea of this follow-up 1 month later, 3 months later, it didn't exist. It didn't even happen. It's not even that he massaged the data to improve it. The people never were surveyed. And it was a huge scandal, and this professor at Columbia got caught in it because he had reviewed the data and they had published it. They published a retraction in Science, and it was a huge problem for everybody involved. This Michael LaCour had been offered a tenure track position at Princeton based on what he had done. Needless to say, he doesn't have that job. Yeah. Now, when I heard this, and of course they had to do another story on it in This American Life, there was part of me that was really kind of, shocked. The scandal of, that level of academic fraud. But there was also a part of me that said, yeah, it sounded too good to be true. Anybody have that reaction? Like this idea that a conversation with somebody, even a personal one, even one led with open-ended questions, that somebody would really change their view. Do people really change their mind? I guess I've been in enough of those conversations to have collected a fair amount of my own evidence. And my own evidence suggests that people don't change their mind. That very, very often, any kind of conversation or debate ends up just reinforcing the opinions of the people who came in to it to begin with. What do you guys think? Yeah. I don't know. The thing is, 2 weeks ago, we came into this room Many of us were all dressed up. We had flowers everywhere. Big jazz band. We had all that big excitement around Easter to celebrate this resurrection of Jesus, the story of Jesus being brought from death to life by God, lifted out of the grave, sent out into the world. I always have this thought every year when we're sort of gearing up for Easter, that we have to go through all that effort, right? We have to make such a big splash out of it because it's so hard to believe. That we kind of like gear ourselves up to kind of step into the hardest part of the Christian faith. I mean, it's one thing to say Jesus had good things to say. He was a great teacher, a wise person, a compassionate example, etc. We can go along with that. But to say that God raised him from the dead, well, that's a bigger leap. That's harder. And so we have to kind of sort of grit ourselves up to get into that part of the story. But I wonder, I mean, is that really the hardest part of this Christian thing? Is that the resurrection that's hardest to accept? I mean, it's one thing to say that God did this one thing to this one person so long ago. What if resurrection challenges us to think that God just didn't do that one thing to Jesus, but that God changes people's minds, that God resurrected Paul? Isn't that the part of the story that is even harder to believe? That anybody who has committed themselves to a path that has a solid and certain worldview, that anything could happen ever to change them in that view. Isn't that hard to believe? We've joked last week, and Tim made mention to it again, that in some ways, Doubting Thomas should be sort of the patron saint of the Kittamakundi community, huh?
I know he is.
But what about, I want to make a counter suggestion. What about Ananias? Ananias is in this story. Did you notice him? Oh, we know the part about Paul and his road to Damascus experience. Sometimes when we recall that story, we think it goes like this. Paul thought one thing, blinding flash of light, voice from the clouds, and now Paul thinks something else. Not quite the details of the story. You go into it. We just recalled that there is a 3-day period of not knowing in between. But then comes the part where Ananias plays a role. Now, Ananias seems to be a Christian. He's a person who has already heard about the resurrection of Jesus. He's a person who has committed himself to that Christian movement, presumably with some excitement around it. But then one night he has a dream. And in the dream, he gets a very sort of specific set of instructions from God, including an address. Did you see that? I think that's interesting. God like knew the GPS coordinates here, and he let, you know, Straight Street, go to Straight Street, turn a left, you know, he tells him exactly where it is, and he says, I want you to go and go see Paul. Now, Ananias has the presence of mind to do something in his dream that not all of us are always able to do in dreams, which is that he responds. And he says to God, but that's a really bad idea. Paul is like a really bad person, and he's very interested in killing people like me. How about I don't go do that? And God replies, whole conversation in this dream, God replies, I've got a plan. I am using Paul as my instrument. I'm at work in Paul's life. Go and do this. Just know I'm involved, right? Ananias wakes up and he goes and does it. Goes to Straight Street and encounters Paul. Interesting story. I relate to Ananias. This is someone who doesn't doubt the resurrection of Jesus. This is somebody who doubts the resurrection of anybody else. That's the harder one. That's the doubt that I think we all share. Not the doubt in this one special person, but the doubt we have in anybody else, in ourselves. That's the doubt that's based on evidence. That's the doubt that all of us as researchers have concluded from our study. There may have been a time when we had trust in somebody's ability to change, believed that when they said, I'll never do that again, that they meant, I'll never do that again. But we have run that study, and we have concluded that those statements most often do not mean anything. That people's statements about their willingness and ability to change are often vastly out of touch with the reality of their lives. And so as a result, in general, we don't believe that people are going to be any different than they are right now. But Ananias goes. He goes because he has faith in resurrection. I don't necessarily think that he believed that things were going to be different with Paul. But he knew enough, believed enough, had enough faith that he was willing to go to Straight Street, go meet Paul, not to argue with him, not to present him with evidence, not to have a discussion, a debate, or even a conversation, but simply to go and meet him and to lay his hands on him, which is to say, to connect with him, to touch him in a way that's not a confrontation, but a blessing. And out of that, something happens. Something changes. A miracle. A miracle. Something that we wouldn't have predicted at the outset occurs. Now, here's the thing. We, like Ananias, we aren't just researchers, right? We are people of faith, which means that we're pushed in our action not just by the evidence of everything that has come before, but by the promise of what might be. The possibility of new life. And we hold on to that hope. And we let that hope, that promise, that vision have influence on us. We let it pull us forward, and not just be pushed by everything that has happened before. What would it be like to live with that kind of faith in resurrection? It doesn't necessarily mean that we know the tactic, that we know the technique, that we know the mechanism for making a change any more than we know what exactly happened inside the tomb. But here's the thing. Here's the thing. God doesn't tell Ananias to change Paul's mind. God tells Ananias to go and lay his hands on him, to make a connection. And he says, I am using Paul as an instrument. That's the only thing Ananias needs to trust. Not in his ability to make a change, not in his knowledge of how to ask the right question, but simply to trust that God is at work in somebody's life, even somebody who we consider an opponent, even somebody who we consider an enemy, even somebody who we consider dangerous, that person is also capable of becoming an instrument of God. What a powerful promise. Now that's a resurrection faith that we can put into operation every single day. One addendum. Yesterday afternoon, after I was talking to Dan in the afternoon, I was having that conversation where we were sort of reviewing what I was going to say this morning. It's hard to be married to a minister. Have to hear the sermon a couple times. And I got to the part where I was telling him about that story on This American Life. And Dan got all excited and he interrupted. And he said, oh my goodness, Heather, They had a follow-up to that story today. Yeah. Did you hear it? You heard it too? He had heard it in the car running errands. I hadn't heard it, so Dan had to summarize, and then I had to look all over the web to see if I could find it. Here's the thing. The reason why they found out that was all fraudulent evidence in that original story, the reason why they found that out is because somebody was trying to replicate the study. They were trying to replicate the results, and that's when they realized that something was fishy. As it turns out, though, those people who were trying to replicate the results went on and did their study anyway. These were people who, they were doing it in Florida, and they were surveying, canvassing around issues around rights for transgendered people. And same situation, going to the door, asking open-ended questions, and ending that with a personal testimony. Some of those people were transgendered themselves, but others just had some connection or issue, or connection to the issue. And they were, at times, 20-minute, even longer, extended personal conversations. And they did the study. They had the control group talking about recycling. They had the survey before and the survey after. And they replicated the results. They did even better than the fraudulent results showed. When I heard that story, I felt like the stone had been rolled back again. I felt like Mary peering into the tomb. And I felt like the thing that I have the least faith in, people, is the very place where God wants to surprise me, wants to surprise us all, because God is active. All we need to do is show up, reach out, and connect. Amen.